From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Remember health care reform, the issue that helped send Bill Clinton to the White House? Today on Democracy Now!, a look at why it failed and what it could mean for the presidential elections. And Whitewater, President Clinton has given over 3 hours of videotaped testimony. Investigative journalist Ken Silverstein will help us unravel it all. Coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington with Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky in Berkeley, California. Welcome, Larry.
Hello, Amy. Another exhausting weekend on the political front.
That's right. And some of the news of this weekend. Today, President Clinton unveils his national drug strategy in Florida with General Barry McCaffrey, the new drug czar. North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms has accused Clinton of not providing leadership on the issue because Clinton doesn't want to remind people he admitted to smoking marijuana. Yesterday on Meet the Press, Tim Russert asked the drug czar if he had ever used drugs. McCaffrey didn't answer the question, and Russert didn't follow up. Today's presidential drug proclamation is surely designed to shift attention from yesterday's four-hour deposition of the president in the Whitewater fraud trial of James McDougal and Judge Hale. Later in the show, we'll be talking about Whitewater with Ken Silverstein of Counterpunch, the newsletter some describe as the modern-day I.F. Stone Weekly.
You know, Amy, there were some 35 people in the room yesterday, according to wire service accounts, when Clinton was giving that tape testimony. And already some accounts of what he said have begun to dribble out. But the more interesting element in this, and the one that I'll be following closely over the next few days, is that this testimony was beamed back to Little Rock via closed-circuit television, presumably on a scrambled signal, so that the judge in the case could rule on evidentiary matters and testimonial matters as they went by. Now, it doesn't take much to fantasize the possibility that somebody with proper decoding equipment could have intercepted that signal, and that right now tapes of President Clinton giving that testimony yesterday, whatever he may or may not have said, are being prepared for who knows what purpose. I imagine a lot of people put a lot of effort into trying to do that.
That's right. I know the White House is demanding that these tapes not be used in commercials. Who knows if they'll actually officially put out the videotape? And there's also questions about an audio tape that is expected to have been made. Well, we're going to talk more about Whitewater in a little while, but first a little more news. Former CIA Director William Colby was reported missing today after a canoe he'd been using was found capsized near his southern Maryland home. Colby disappeared last night, and Coast Guard crews searched a river in the vicinity of his Rock Point home for more than 5 hours. They're scheduled to resume the search this morning. William Colby was CIA director from 1973 to 1976 under Presidents Nixon and Ford. And this weekend, more than 100 people celebrated the 90th birthday of retired Supreme Court Justice William Brennan. As he sat in his wheelchair, his son read his speech, calling the death penalty a barbaric and inhuman punishment that violates our Constitution. His comments come just after a week after President Clinton signed the bipartisan so-called counterterrorism bill, which includes unprecedented limits on appeals by death row inmates. President Clinton again extolled the virtues of the law last night in D.C. as he joined Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres in addressing AIPAC, the policy conference, the American-Israel Political Affairs Committee. Clinton is the first president to address the powerful Washington lobby while he was officially president. And back to domestic issues, the Kassebaum-Kennedy bill, passed last week by the Senate, now goes to conference committee. The bill forbids companies from denying coverage to people with a pre-existing condition and requires that insurance companies allow policyholders to take their insurance with them if they switch jobs. However, it doesn't put a cap on the cost of that insurance. While the bill has been hailed by many consumer groups, it is seen as a tiny improvement in overall health care system that is terminally ill. In 1992, health care was on the top of President Clinton's campaign agenda. Today on Democracy Now!, a debate on what happened, why we see so little change. Joining us in our studios here in Washington are three guests. David Broder and Haynes Johnson are familiar faces on PBS and the networks, and they've both been reporters for The Washington Post. Together, they've written the new book, The American Way of Politics at the Breaking Point. It's called The System. John Canham Klein is research director for Ralph Nader's Congress Watch and is co-author of The Rational Option for a National Health Program. Let's begin with David Broder. You talked to more than 100 people involved with the health care reform debacle, including the president, Hillary Clinton, and Bob Dole. Can you sum up your conclusions about what you think went wrong?
Well, a lot of things went wrong, but I think the central thing was that President Clinton overestimated his political capital, went for a very ambitious, if well sort of articulated, comprehensive solution, failed to muster the political effort that was needed, and ran up against an opposition organized in Congress by Newt Gingrich, who saw this as a crucial test for conservative versus liberal philosophy, and mobilized on the outside by interest groups that have put together a capacity for campaigning at the grassroots that is probably the equal, or if not the superior, to that of either of the political parties.
Bad as that is, what I get from reading your book was that you and Haynes Johnson believe that something even worse was and is going on in the United States, that there's an assault, as you put it, on the idea of responsible government, that we have a thoroughly cynical society that distrusts its institutions, that we're heading away from ideas of charity and compassion to a social Darwinist society. I know it's very difficult for you to sum up a 700-page book in just a phrase, Haynes Johnson, but how did we get to such a lamentable point?
Larry, we wrote this book because we felt exactly what you've just described, that the people everywhere in the country have real doubts about the way the system is working as it was designed to work, that is, to serve the people, not in an ideological way, but across the board. And this has been growing. This is not a new phenomenon, this the doubt and the distrust in the political feelings in this country. It has been growing for a very long time, and it's increasingly become more and more clear that somehow people feel it's been broken and it isn't working. We wrote this book, The System, as a way to try to explain through one issue, health care, that touches everyone, how well did the system serve the people? In this case, as David just said, my colleague David Broder just said, it didn't, and there are lessons for all of us in that failure.
What do you think are the most important lessons?
David has said some of them. First of all, you shouldn't try to do too much too fast. It was too big and too ambitious a program. Second of all, you have to build your majorities, and you've got to be clear with the public. They were outgunned, outmanned, and we ran up in reporting this book. Both David and I have covered politics for our lifetime now. We never had seen such an array of sophisticated grassroots ability to manufacture and manipulate opinion as we saw here.
John Canham Klein, your assessment of what went wrong. Do you agree with David Broder and Haynes Johnson?
Well, I think the central idea of the book is a very good one. That is that the healthcare fight in the last Congress is a terrific prism through which to view how our political system works. And I also think that David and Haynes did a really nice job in analyzing the very deep divisions within the Democratic Party. I think, however, that they might have taken a little harder look at the substance of the various plans involved. On health care, substance more than anything else is politics. As James Fallows put it in his recent book on the media, when it comes to health care, there are two choices, single payer and everything else. A single payer system, of course, being a tax-financed national health insurance system. President Clinton chose a version of everything else, that is, attempting to compromise with the insurance industry, keep it in play, and keep it in command of the health care system. And he paid an enormous political price because he sacrificed his ability to generate grassroots support for his plan by doing so.
You think
Why wasn't he able to get the insurance industry on his side behind him and then pass his plan, if indeed the insurance industry is so powerful, John Canham Klein?
Because the basic goal of achieving universal coverage is largely irreconcilable with maintaining private insurance control over the system. Private insurance basically does not work to promote universal coverage, doesn't in this country, isn't doing so anywhere else. And those countries that do rely on private companies to manage their healthcare systems have a much, much tighter regulatory scheme than the domestic insurance industry would ever be willing to accept.
Why do you think single payer was so written off when, in fact, it had more co-sponsors than any other proposal? Yet in the Washington Post, in the New York Times, you rarely saw extensive pieces about it in the way you did the other proposals.
Well, I think David did a column several weeks ago in which he took issue with a study by Chuck Lewis and the Center for Public Integrity as asserting that our political system boils down to a system of legalized bribery in which there's a sort of a straightforward exchange of votes for money and campaign contributions. And I think in some sense David was right that it's not that simple. The way our system works is that unless you have a powerful moneyed interest behind your work, behind your bill, you're really not going to go anywhere. And the only possible source of that sort of moneyed support was labor. And labor was badly divided over health care at the time and was pretty much willing to go with whatever President Clinton would have proposed.
John, though, but let me come back again to what I just asked you. If you're correct and you need a big moneyed interest behind you to get something done, you write in your book, The Rational Option, that the entire managed competition approach was essentially an insurance industry proposal for reorganization, which would increase the insurer's dominance over healthcare. The insurance industry is not nothing when it comes to money and power. Why weren't they able to get the Clinton plan over?
Well, the entire health industry was scared to death after the 92 campaign because it was clear that the American people desperately want this system fixed and desperately want to see some sort of universal coverage scheme. That sense of political inevitability is what put health care into play in the first place. And as long as everybody believed that there was going to be a bill, this was the best bill that the insurance industry, especially the large insurers, could envision that would include universal coverage. When it became clear that there could be no bill, that that was a genuine and legitimate option, and David Haynes did a nice job showing how Newt Gingrich had that strategy the whole time. Once that became clear, then the insurance industry realized that it could gobble up the market without any regulatory controls, as it has been doing for the last 3 years with these enormous mergers that you're seeing, the most recent one, of course, being Aetna and U.S. Healthcare.
David Broder, do you agree with John's assessment?
Well, John makes a very good case, as many others have done, that logically, the single-payer or Canadian-style system is the most efficient way to approach this problem. Indeed, there was a Congressional Budget Office study that suggested that larger savings and guaranteed coverage for everybody were obtainable through this system. But from the perspective that we were coming at, which was what was the on the table at that point, Jim McDermott, the congressman from Washington State who led the single-payer forces, was, I think, realistic when he said, we do not have a majority in sight for our approach to this thing. So he, along with many others like John Dingell and John Lewis, who really preferred and thought logically, as John argues, that single-payer was the way to go, said, we have a moment here with a president and a first lady committed to putting this on the agenda, and their approach, even though it's not our approach, is the most significant potential step forward that we have seen in this area in our lifetime in politics. So we're going to try to move in that direction.
Haynes Johnson, do you think that President Clinton and Hillary Clinton, if they had made a real case for single payer, do you think they could have galvanized the American population and even beat the big moneyed interests, the insurance industry?
Maybe, but probably not. I think the larger question here, and we're sort of all talking about the same thing, is this American system, our governmental political system, able to deal with these huge changes overnight, instantly? That's what the healthcare debate was about. John said that the people desperately wanted it fixed. Yes, they did, but they weren't willing to pay for it. And this country from the beginning has been fearful of government, particularly in the last 20 years, the question Larry asked, about the power of government to intrude upon your life. Now, this may be a specter, it may be a false fear, and a lot of it was manipulated and so forth. But nonetheless, that's real. And you make change in this country usually in a sort of gradual process, step by step. That's how that Medicare began over years and years. We've been debating health care reform for this entire century. And when David and I were looking back at the record of it, it's so clear over and over and over again, the same thing keeps coming, and it's being defeated by the same reasons. So I think from the president's standpoint, yes, he might have been able to, he's a wonderful communicator, etc., but I doubt it. I think he would have been much wiser to have sort of taken something like the Kennedy-Kassebaum-Kennedy and said, this is a way to begin, to lay the floor, not have a Taj Mahal overnight, build the foundation first and then build it up.
I think one of the best contributions towards understanding that comes from your book, Haynes Johnson and David Broder, your new book, The System, where you talk about, and maybe you can talk a little here, about the incredibly complex, difficult, secretive, and unwieldy process by which the Clinton administration decided it was going to get a proposal for health care reform led by Ira Magaziner and the whole mess that that became. Why, in your mind, did the president and Hillary Clinton decide to bypass the lawmaking structure that we have known as Congress on Capitol Hill and basically try to reinvent government through this enormous apparatus, which I believe you say at one point had more than 1,000 people working in it?
David Broder.
They did it essentially because the presidency has become isolated and weakened in our whole system. That's one of the major lessons which we draw from this whole study of this of what happened in healthcare. The president came to Washington as an outsider. He didn't trust Congress. He didn't even trust the departments in his own government to do this job. So he said, we're going to write this ourselves, right inside the White House. He picked his wife as the head of it. He picked his old friend Ira Magaziner as the chief of staff of the operation and said, we're going to do this ourselves, and we're going not to share very much about it with anybody else. He paid a very high price for that, as he acknowledged himself. One of the stunning things that happened in our reporting was that in summer of 1995, we sat down in the Oval Office with President Clinton and asked him, what do you lessons do you draw from this about the way the system operates? And he said, quote, I set the Congress up for failure. Now,
but
in a long time of reporting, I have never heard a president say anything like that.
Right, David Broder. But if you're Tom Foley, then Speaker of the House, or you're George Mitchell, Senate Majority Leader, don't you go to him right away and say, you don't do business like this in this town, Mr. President? You got to come to us. This is the way things happen. You're setting yourself up for a huge failure right here. Don't Foley and Mitchell tell him that?
Let me try that, Larry. This is Haynes, but because, yes, you'd think so, except there was this big difference. The leaders of Congress and the president had control for the first time, one party, of both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue. They had the White House, they had the Congress, they had both houses. This hadn't happened since Jimmy Carter, and it's almost a generation before. And one of the lessons of the Carter presidency was the failure for the president to work together with the leaders of Congress. And they made the point, we'll support you, the leaders of Congress, Mr. President, this is Bill Clinton, but we've got to work together on this thing, and we have to coordinate our policies and so forth. And it wasn't a matter of bullying each other. The leaders wanted health reform, but they also were aware of the difficulties, and it showed you the disillusion or disintegration of the Democratic Party also, in failing to get it through.
Also, in pure human terms, if the President of the United States says to the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader of the Senate, I want my wife to do this, what are they going to say to him?
Well, I think
no. How about no?
Let me just say there was we don't deal with anonymous sources, but this one had to be anonymous. It was a top person involving in the process and told us, he said, the problem of this is, Haynes and Dave, he said, when the president proposed his wife, he said, that's a good idea because it showed that he cared about it more than anybody else, and he had respect for her, and this was central, number one. But the problem is the person who has this policy initiative shouldn't sleep with the president, because nobody else will ever tell the president the truth. And that's really what happened.
This is John, Larry. I sort of agree with Haynes to some extent, although the crucial factor in the task force was that it was to some extent largely a phony exercise. The crucial decisions were made relatively early on. As I said, the decision whether to go with single payer or not. And more importantly, what the task force exercised was an attempt to figure out the best available compromise that would achieve universal coverage. That is, before the deal-making even began in Congress, the task force was trying to gaze into a crystal ball, come up with something that they thought they could get out of Congress with several sort of fallback positions on each of the crucial issues, financing and other issues like that. And what happened was President Clinton misunderstood the nature of the fight they were in. David and Haynes lay out very carefully and I think in really nice detail how the opposition demonized the Clinton plan as a big government plan. The problem is virtually whatever came out of the White House was going to face that assault. Newt Gingrich and Citizens for Sound Economy and the entire right-wing network were going to call whatever came from the White House big government, socialized medicine, because those are the traditional scare words in the health reform debate. The problem is that President Clinton had to have something that he could take to the people and explain carefully, accurately, and persuasively. And he didn't come out with that. And I actually agree with Haynes that if President Clinton had put forward single payer, in all likelihood he would not have gotten single payer. He might have gotten a bill, though, because he would have been able to pull the debate in his direction. I personally think that there were not the votes for any bill in the last Congress.
John, when we come back, we're going to ask about Robert Dole's role in all of this. We're talking to John Canham Klein. He's author of The Rational Option for a National Health Program, and we're talking to Haynes Johnson and David Broder, authors of the new book, The System, The American Way of Politics at the Breaking Point. You're listening to Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington. Larry Bensky joining us from Berkeley, California. Our guest, John Canham Klein, who is research director of Congress Watch, which is a part of Public Citizen, Ralph Nader's group here in Washington. He's also author of The Rational Option for a National Health Program. And we're joined by Haynes Johnson and David Broder, author of the new book, The System, The American Way of Politics at the Breaking Point. I remember at the beginning of the whole health care reform effort, a picture in the New York Times of the Jackson Hole group. There was a picture of Ira Magaziner and Hillary Clinton and all of the people, the sort of inner circle. There wasn't one consumer advocate there, anyone representing the general population. You had the Hospitals Association, you had the insurance companies, and they said this was the inner group. Were consumer activists completely excluded, John?
To a large measure, they were. There were single-payer advocates on the task force, although they had relatively little influence. As I said, the basic decisions, as Haynes and David show in their book, were made by the political people at the White House. And the intellectual background that Magaziner and a number of the other folks who were the crucial decision makers in the crafting of the plan was the belief that you couldn't do this without the insurance industry, and that private insurance is the private sector is necessarily more efficient than the government. That's simply not true. Private insurers actually spend a whole lot more money on bureaucracy than does a program like Medicare. And in that sense, the important thing to understand about the single-payer movement is that it wasn't a Washington movement. David and Haynes set the scene at the President Clinton's address to Congress. They open the book that way and introduce all their players. And it's a nice technique, and they mentioned that Jim McDermott had 89 co-sponsors on the single-payer bill. He started out with 55. And what happened was, through grassroots pressure, another 34 signatures wound up on that bill because church groups, healthcare groups, consumer groups, some unions went from member to member to member to member and said, sign this bill, get on this bill. And most of them, David Korn tells a great story about Tom Lantos, who sort of resignedly shrugs his shoulders and says, okay, I'll sign the bill. You know we're not going to get this, but just to make you happy, I'll do it. And the pressure, the movement for single payer is not a Washington-based movement, but it did represent a very strong grassroots network that the Clinton administration essentially demoralized by bringing out the plan that they did. And they had
to go back.
Wait a
minute, John. If you say that it's not a Washington-based network, where is it based? It's certainly not based here in California, where they got single-payer on the ballot with a huge effort to gather signatures and saw it get about 26% of the votes,
sure.
Overwhelmingly defeated.
Oh, absolutely. It was overwhelmingly defeated, but it was also defeated in the political environment that David and Haynes have described, where a massive nationwide movement had scared the pants off of everybody who might be interested in any sort of government intrusion into the healthcare economy.
And so what's the lesson here? You really have to have an organization, as David and Haynes write in their book. At its peak, the Democratic Party had perhaps 24 organizers in the field building support for the Clinton bill. In contrast, there were 300 paid organizers working for Democratic candidates in California alone during the 1994 congressional campaign.
Larry, I think that's a very important point, because in our system, interest groups all across the spectrum play in our politics, and in my view ought to play in our politics. People come together out of common interests, whether they're consumers or producers or manufacturers, what it may be. But in this fight and in many other fights, there is such an imbalance in the organizational and financial resources that it's not a fair fight. I think, John, there was at least one important consumer group that was very much in touch with the Clintons while they were putting this plan together. Families USA was very much involved. But you're right in the point that you made earlier, that this really goes back to a choice not this. When the task force met, President Clinton had already given them the clear direction that he wanted to go. He made those choices in the 1992 campaign. He wanted to campaign as a new Democrat. And it would have been, in his view and in mine, frankly, wholly inconsistent for somebody who had striking that basic posture in the campaign then to come out and advocate a single-payer plan.
David Broder and Haynes Johnson, isn't there also another problem with trying to another enemy of single-payer, and that is the corporate media that you work for, both the networks, the large papers, you both with the Washington Post, Haynes, you were, the New York Times, just like with NAFTA, overwhelmingly pro-NAFTA, pro the position of the corporations, and you have here, you know, very much excluding the voice that was represented in Congress, again, more co-sponsors than any other bill for single-payer, yet if you questioned the American population, they would know very, very little about it. Didn't the media, the corporate media, contribute to that?
Amy, we quote John Kennedy on the Bay of Pigs failure the day after it failed at the beginning of this book. Says, victory has 1,000 fathers and defeat is an orphan. There are orphans all over the place in this. The press failed. The interests failed. The public was let down. The Democratic Party classically failed. Clinton failed. And there are lessons on this. One thing, don't take so much time, John, when you start this process. It took them 9 months to get a bill to Congress. That's number one. Number two, what Larry was talking about, other lessons. The unity of the Republican Congress early under Gingrich was exactly what the Democrats didn't have. They learned the lessons of this. Write the bill themselves. Get it out fast. Don't allow it to be lobbied and pressured around. That may not be a good Democratic process, small d, but they learned some of the lessons of trying to get things through our very complicated system.
So is that what the system is then, a process of befuddling and overwhelming the public? Is this your conclusion when you call your book The System, that it's actually not a thing but a process, and that that process is gargantuan and very ugly and not democratic?
No, I don't really agree with that process. It is very gargantuan. It can be very ugly. It was in this fight. It was tragic. It should have worked better. But there are lessons. If the public understands there's something that affects their lives, they have to be involved in themselves to sort out misinformation. The press has to do a better job. All of these things have to come together to make great changes. Otherwise, you do it piece by piece.
You know what lesson I would draw from your book? If I wanted to get something done, I'd join the National Federation of Independent Business.
Well, they were pretty good.
you make them out to be the most powerful thing in Washington.
Well, they are pretty good, but at the moment they are on the losing side of this fight over the minimum wage battle. So politics is not, there is not a preordained conclusion. And Amy, to respond directly to your question about the coverage of the single-payer plan, I don't think it was reflective of some sort of corporate media agenda. The fact of the matter is that we in the press failed pretty much across the board to explain what the alternatives were here. The single-payer plan like the Republican alternative, which actually had more sponsors than the single-payer plan did, never got very much attention because we were struggling throughout to try to explain this very complicated proposal of the Clintons, and we failed even to do that very well.
But I think it also has to do with the sort of regular, the usual suspects on the corporate media. For example, Ralph Nader was recently on the show that you're a frequent guest of Meet the Press. It was the first time he was on in 18 years. It took him running for president to get on that show. Why aren't these voices, you know, there on a regular basis? And then you might not have so much trouble explaining these alternatives.
Well, I don't. That may be, but I don't think that's the real problem here. I mean, if we do our jobs, if the groups do their jobs, if the elected officials do their jobs, then the country has enough information to make a choice. They didn't want this big program they couldn't understand. They were easily frightened by it, and it was a tragedy that it failed.
I mean, let me make.
But they wanted universal coverage, didn't they? I mean,
not Larry so much that they wanted it in theory. But if they thought they would have to pay a heavy price for those who didn't have it, that was part of the difficulty of this problem.
That's not necessarily true. There have been consistent polls that show a majority in favor of spending of increasing taxes to achieve universal coverage. The problem is that the president's plan was in fact extremely bureaucratic, would have in fact been very costly, and was in many cases didn't necessarily offer an improvement in coverage. When I started out, I said politics is substance when it comes to health care. Let me give you an example. Haynes and David talk about how the AARP was very slow to get behind the Clinton plan. I think in that sense they served their constituents quite well, because it was not at all clear for seniors who are enrolled in Medicare now that the Clinton plan represented an improvement in benefits. And the reason that I thought that single-payer was a better political vehicle for the president is that he could have taken single-payer to seniors and said, quite simply, here's what you have now in Medicare, and you're spending on average more than $2,300 out of pocket every year. You're not going to be spending that anymore. Whereas Clinton had to go to them and say, well, if you're willing to go into a tightly controlled HMO, give up your traditional relationship with your doctors, then you're going to get some pharmaceutical benefits. If you want to continue to have your choice of doctor, well, then you're going to have to spend $2,500 out of pocket to cover your deductibles and co-payments. The thing about single payer is that it was better substantively, and for that reason, it was also better politically, because it could be sold both to interest groups and because it was more simple to the public at large.
You have to wonder what the AARP's agenda was when you pick up today's newspaper and find out that it's going to license managed health care plans?
Sure, that's
and
all.
And that its 33 million members are
That was a big problem in the Medicare fight. AARP was kept quiet because they already market so-called Medigap policies to their members, so they have a financial stake in the private system. They're like any other group. You have to move them. And the reason single payer would have been appropriate it would have also been a lever against the leadership of the AARP.
Larry, your point about AARP today's story about their getting an HMOs just shows you that politics is also very big self-interest.
We're talking to Haynes Johnson and David Broder, authors of The System, The American Way of Politics at the Breaking Point, and John Canham Klein. His book is The Rational Option for a National Health Program, Bob Dole, the role he played in the demise of any kind of health care reform.
Clinton said to us and other people that and his frustration was that every time he tried to move the debate to the middle, Bob Dole moved it to the right. And you saw this process go on and on. Bob Dole, from the beginning, was for health reform. He had been active in the past for other kinds of advantage. He suffers terribly from his wounds in World War II. He went through 9 operations, veterans hospitals. He understands the pain and suffering, but his presidential ambitions, you could see, kept pulling him. He was tugged and tugged and tugged to the right. Don't you agree, David?
Yes, as the Republican Party moved to the right, Bob Dole moved with it, continues to move with it, to the point that his top staff person, Sheila Burke, said to him at one point, we quote her in the book, as saying Dole had co-sponsored a fairly significant piece of health care legislation with Senator John Chafee of Rhode Island. And Sheila Burke turns to him and said, you can't be for that bill any longer.
And that's the real underlying pressures that it's human ambitions as well as corporate ambitions as well as personal misjudgments that play it in this kind of a big story.
What's really interesting.
So whose goal is it to provide affordable quality health care for all then? Whose goal is that really? That's the bottom line as far as I'm concerned whole discussion.
The important point, and I think the point that I believe gives our book The System relevance today is the public demand for this is still there.
Right.
This is very high on the political agenda today after the Democrats failed with their effort, after the Republicans failed with their effort to reform or change Medicare and Medicaid. The public still says we want this problem solved. And the challenge for the politicians today in the system is still to find a way to deal with this public demand.
Larry, I covered the civil rights revolution for many, many years, and you could see how the pressure.
You won a Pulitzer Prize for doing so.
Well, thank you for remembering that. But yes, I did. But if you could see in the very beginning, it took bloodshed, hard, and defeat after defeat, and you keep coming back, and you build a constituency for change.
You know, we introduced all of you, but we didn't introduce another set of guests. They're the foremen, and this is what they have to say about what Clinton did with health care reform.
Well, come on, everybody, get into the spin. Now that he's been in for however long it's been. Grin a good old grin, tuck in your second chin, and everybody do the Clinton. Come on and slide over to the middle.
Over to the middle.
Straighten up and step light.
Up and step light.
Lean it to the left a little.
To the left a little.
Now lean a lot to the right.
Lot to the
Come
right.
Come on and take a definite position.
Definite position.
Now do a total turnabout.
Total turnabout.
Shake your finger at the media. See how good they'll be to you.
Everybody do the Clinton.
And you're listening to Do the Clinton by the Foremen on their CD, Folk Heroes. You think that accurately describes what Clinton was doing?
It does have the complicated tangle and shifting left and right center. And that's the way our system is sort of tangled at
if
the moment.
If we could package that CD with a book, we'd really be able to go
We want a copy as we head out on the road promoting this
you
book.
You know, clearly Emma Goldman couldn't dance to that tune. And I guess, as she says, if I can't dance to it, I don't want to be a part of your revolution. We got to sum up now. And the question is how this is going to play out between Dole and Clinton in the 96 elections. What do you think, David Broder?
It will have to be on the agenda for both these people because the public is insisting that this question come back up again. Senator Dole at the moment is, I have to say bluntly, sabotaging an effort to get modest health insurance reform through the Congress, undercutting his own colleague, Nancy Kassebaum. I'd be very surprised if President Clinton doesn't make this an issue.
Also, I think this is so important to people in the country. Everybody understands they have a stake in it. We're all going to be a part of the health process system at some point in our lives, and the costs are going up. There are 2 million more people without health insurance today than when we started this book, and the sense of dislocation, downsizing in America makes people anxious. This is an enormous question that has not been resolved.
I'll be very interested after you do your book tour to talk to you again and see if you, as you both are, good reporters, listeners, listen to people and actually find them bringing it up. Because as I ran around the country covering many of the primaries, I didn't hear it on the top of people's lists anymore.
We'd love to talk. In fact, that would be very interesting. We'll find out, too. We don't know the answer to that question.
And John Canham Klein, I'm actually a little surprised that you pretty much concede single payer cannot be the alternative in this country right now.
Well, I don't concede that at all. I concede that it would be – I assert that it would be very easy to build a majority public sentiment for it if you were to – if someone like the President of the United States were to make it a legislative priority. I think that our current Congress does not have the votes to pass single payer. Certainly the Republican Congress did. And frankly, the Democratic Congress last time didn't either because the majority – The majority was held by the Republicans and, frankly, President Clinton's faction of the Democratic Party. Until the Democratic Party sorts out which side it stands on and whether it's going to be, like the Republicans, hostage to corporate interests or whether it's going to stand for the people, you're going to see the same kind of muddling through and, frankly, no consensus at all. The major issue I take with Haynes and David's book is that they assert that people are fed up with partisanship. In the most recent debate over Medicare and even over national health reform, there was, I think, too much consensus that that the private insurance industry has to continue to control our health insurance. It's been failing for 60 years to cover everyone. It's still failing now, and it's not doing so in any country in the world.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for joining us. Again, the new book by Haynes Johnson and David Broder is The System, The American Way of Politics at the Breaking Point. And John Canham Klein's book is called The Rational Option for a National Health Program. John Canham Klein is research director for Congress Watch, which is a part of Ralph Nader's Public Citizen Group. And Haynes Johnson, a longtime writer, Pulitzer Prize winner for the book Sleepwalking Through History. And David Broder, reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you very much for joining us on Democracy Now.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I am Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky, and we'll be back. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington. Larry Bensky is with us in Berkeley, California. This weekend, President Clinton gave a 3.5 hours of videotaped testimony to be used in the bank fraud and conspiracy trial of his former Whitewater real estate business partners, James and Susan McDougall. The McDougals are accused of scheming to get $3 million in illegal loans. President Clinton isn't charged with any wrongdoing in the case, but David Hale, a witness for the prosecution, alleges that Clinton pressured him to approve an illegal loan to Susan McDougall. Joining us now is Ken Silverstein, co-editor of Counterpunch, a political newsletter, and co-author with Alexander Coburn of the new book, Washington Babylon, new from Verso Books. Ken Silverstein, we actually had you on Democracy Now! About a month ago talking about a story around Bill Clinton and Whitewater that I have heard no one else talking about. What is your assessment of Clinton's involvement in Whitewater and whether this is significant at all?
Well, I think it's clearly significant. I think too many people on the left end of the political spectrum want to wish it away and pretend it's not significant at all. You hear a lot of people say, oh, Kenneth Starr is biased, and this is all a Republican plot, and Al D'Amato is out to get the president. Well, I think those are issues to be looked at, but they're not terribly relevant. Back in the 1980s, imagine if if you heard people say, oh, the Iran-Contra scandal, it's all a bunch of junk. It's just a Democratic plot to get President Reagan.
You know, we did hear people say that, Ken. We heard them say it loud and clear.
Right, they did, but we certainly wouldn't have said, oh, and that's a relevant point. That's a salient fact. We should just not pay attention to this because it's all a plot. Look, of course the Republicans are playing partisan politics with this, but really that's not relevant. The facts are what's relevant, and the facts have to be explored. So I think you've got to look at the situation and not just say, oh, well, it's all a plot, and not just think, well, this could hurt Clinton and we want Bob Dole.
Well, I want to get to the substance of it, but I do think you can't just write off the conflict of interest here. You've got Ken Starr, the prosecutor representing Brown and Williamson, one of the largest tobacco companies. Clearly, the tobacco interests have a great deal of interest in not seeing President Clinton reelected, and the FDA Commissioner Kessler, who has a real vendetta against the tobacco companies. And you could even see some kind of deal being struck. You know, we'll lay off you to President Clinton if you lay off us. There are real conflicts here, it seems to me.
There are conflicts of interest. I wouldn't say there aren't. I don't mean to say that there aren't conflicts of interest. I simply think that it's wrong and completely dishonest to write off the entire Whitewater investigation as a Republican plot. And I think that if the tables were turned, people would sneer at this sort of thing. I'll give you another example. People talk about Hillary Clinton and the $100,000 she made on her $1,000 investment in the futures markets. Just think for a second. Go back to the 1980s. Let's say Nancy Reagan had been involved in that sort of a deal, where she made a lot of money and there were favors traded to by the Reaganites to powerful private interests. Can you imagine if anyone on the left-hand side of the spectrum would be saying, "Oh, you know, this isn't really such a big deal. I mean, she made $100,000 on a $1,000 investment, but let's not really pay too close attention to this." Of course not. Nancy Reagan, you would have had guests in here, Amy, time after time, who would be trashing Nancy Reagan for this crude manipulation and dishonesty. So let's look at the facts.
So you're saying we should be trashing Hillary Clinton, or that we should be looking at what's wrong with the political system that allowed this type of activity to take place? Because having people in to bash Nancy Reagan or Hillary Clinton doesn't seem to be terribly productive.
Well, I'd say we need to do both. I'd say first we should look at the political system that allows that sort of influence peddling. But second, yes, I think Hillary Clinton should be trashed. I'm sorry. She made $100,000 on a $1,000 investment. You or I would have been called in. Our investment would have been called in. We would have been wiped out. Why wasn't Hillary? Because Hillary was the wife of a very powerful political figure. Yes, I think Hillary should be trashed.
Go through it again. How did she make the money?
Look, it's a very risky business. It's futures trading. She only put down $1,000 on her initial investment. And at a certain point, she was actually cashed out. She was deeply, deeply in the red. But because she was the wife of a powerful political figure, and that figure, her husband, Bill Clinton, then governor, could possibly do important favors down the road, she was allowed to stay in the market. And she turned that $1,000, thanks to this favor, into $100,000. Now, the odds have been calculated at doing that at about 4 billion to 1. You've got a better chance to win the lottery than you do to take $1,000 and turn it into $100,000 in the futures market.
In your March 15th issue of Counterpunch, your newsletter, your headline is Hillary a crook? Is she?
Is she a crook? Well, I think that there is substantial evidence that Hillary and Bill Clinton have been involved in a number of shady dealings. I will leave it to the grand jury to decide whether Hillary is a crook, whether she should be indicted in any case. But certainly, if you look at the record, if you look at the all the influence peddling that went on back then, Hillary has a lot to answer for. Go back to 1978. Bill Clinton is running for governor. He and Hillary at that time were strapped for money, and they were pleading with McDougal to come up with some money-making deal. So McDougal finds the Whitewater property, which is outside the town of Flippin in the Ozarks, and he gets the investment off the ground. And very shortly after that, Clinton, in 3 months after these initial contacts, Clinton was elected governor. And he soon appointed McDougal as the chief financial advisor in his administration. You see this sort of influence peddling, this trading of money for political favors all the time with Bill and Hillary. It's something that has dogged them throughout their public careers.
And what politician could you refer us to on the national level that's not true of? Bob Dole?
Well, I mean, is this a defense? Because everybody else
does
it,
it's
okay?
No, I'm not saying it's a defense. No, I'm not saying it's a defense. I just want to know why you're focusing your energies on Bill Clinton and not, say, Bob Dole or Pete Wilson here in California.
Focus our energy on Bob Dole whenever the opportunity arises. I guess one of the reasons we focus a lot of attention on the Clintons is because so many people, so many so-called progressives, want to just wish this whole thing away. Of course we talk about Bob Dole. We recently had a story in our newsletter about Bob Dole's fantastic favorites for the U.S. Tobacco Company, which is a big contributor to Bob Dole's campaigns. It flies him around on its corporate jet, and Bob Dole does all sorts of favors. I mean,
which progressives do you find, Ken Silverstein, who want to wish this thing away?
Well, I mean, I urge you to read the last few issues of The Nation magazine, for example. I mean, they've been going after Kenneth Starr as if he's the crux of the matter.
In what way does that indicate a desire to wash things away rather than to show another element of the corruption involved here?
I think there are I think if you look at the record of the left press in examining Whitewater, you'll find a fairly shameful whitewash of the situation. There's very little critical reporting. If the Nation, instead of focusing on Kenneth Starr, looked at the facts, I think the facts of the matter are more important than the conflicts of interest, the admitted conflicts of interest around Kenneth Starr. I think a lot of people on the left are very worried that Bob Dole is going to become president this fall, or that there's a risk of that, of course, anyway, and therefore they don't want to pay attention to Bill Clinton's problems.
Let me go back to that question. Do you think, are you concerned, considering your assessment of the Clintons, that Bill Clinton would go soft on tobacco if Ken Starr, who represents big tobacco interests, would lay off him?
Well, Bill Clinton goes soft. I mean, Bill Clinton going soft is the sort of mark of his entire career. I mean, the man is as soft as the Pillsbury Doughboy. I mean, he goes soft on just about everybody.
He jogs every morning, Ken.
He does indeed jog every morning.
He food binges every night, apparently.
What about Dialing for Dollars, your piece on Hillary's phone calls to James McDougal? I mean, there's definitely a fact that, as Karen Friedman said of the oh-so-politically-correct players, what water? No one even understands what we're talking about. So I do think getting into some substance would be helpful. What about the latest story we heard about Hillary Clinton's fingerprints on the documents that were found in the White House study? And also your story about Hillary's phone calls to James McDougal.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Newsweek's coming out with a story today saying that Hillary's fingerprints were on these records that turned up, in January. And the records indicate that Hillary did a lot of work on behalf of the Madison Guarantee. And she has said that she can't remember any of this work. Very convenient memory. So,
aren't they saying, though, what, 60 hours over a year?
That's right.
Is that a lot of work?
It seems to me that it's a fair amount of work. It's something you certainly would remember. I mean, I think that if I'd done 60 hours of work on any given project, I'd have a pretty strong recollection of it. I mean, I don't remember. It's become Hillary's standard line in so many ways. Yeah, she had said that she couldn't remember any of this. She said that she'd never solicited any work from McDougal, and on and on. And I think the records are tending to contradict that. That's one possible indictment from the grand jury, is on perjury charges, because she's claimed she can't remember any of this.
Well, now stop right there. What happens to the Clinton campaign if his wife is indicted on felony charges by a federal grand jury? Have you thought about that?
Well,
does Bill Clinton still get the Democratic nomination for president, or are we talking about Al Gore here?
Well, that's one of those questions that it's very hard to answer. I mean, obviously, if Hillary Clinton is indicted by a grand jury, and particularly given that it's not as if Bill Clinton is completely uninvolved in the activities that she would be indicted for, it's going to be a terribly damaging blow to Clinton, whether Gore would be called on to step in and take his place. I mean, there's no way I can do anything but speculate about that. I suspect Bill Clinton will be the candidate come November.
Being the stickler for little facts and details here to understand this complex story, again, Hillary's phone calls to James McDougal.
Well, I mean, Bill and Hillary both were making phone calls to James McDougal about money. I mean, they were both in desperate need of money, and they were constantly hitting on McDougal, who, in James Stewart's new book, sort of indicated a certain displeasure about being constantly hit on, although at the same time he recognized that his fate to a certain extent was tied to theirs. Look, I mean, you'll see all the time Bill and Hillary using their connections with McDougal. I mean, in 81, Clinton is elected governor. 4 years later, he jogs into McDougal's office and he asks McDougal to send a little action Hillary's way because she's in trouble at Rose Law Firm. She's not getting enough work. And so McDougal put her on retainer for $20,000 a year, I believe it was. So, I mean, there's a clear there's all sorts of trading off of political favors.
You know, Ken, the thing that bothers me about this, and you say, you know, well, are you defending it by saying that everybody does it? Is it, damn it, everybody does do it. I mean, the process you're just describing of a politician getting business for his or her family and friends and one hand washing the other and campaign contributions flowing like a mighty stream from the wealthy and the powerful towards those that they favor is the way that this country runs. Now, if Alphonse D'Amato and Kenneth Starr are to be seen as the type of people who are purifying this society. There's something totally cockeyed in this. And you're saying that this is a leftist way of avoiding the truth seems to me to be a way of avoiding the fact that everybody in this could be a bad guy. Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Alphonse D'Amato, Kenneth Starr, and the whole damn system is what I'm saying.
Well, I'm always stunned at how people harp on this. I just find it appalling that, you know, by conjuring up the image of the horrible D'Amato, who, of course, D'Amato's a complete hypocrite. I mean, he's one of the biggest sleazebags in American politics. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if...
Why doesn't that matter?
Because if the facts that D'Amato's dredging up are damaging to the Clintons, then it doesn't matter who's dredging them up. It could be
Al
D'Amato.
Are they
Yes,
are
look,
they damaging to the Clintons?
They are damaging, and it's far more... I mean, you keep saying, oh, it's everybody does it. This is more than what everybody does, okay? You're talking about, for example, you've got David Hale, who, if his story is true...
There's a big if there.
Okay, sure. I can't swear to you that his story is true, but, I mean, it's certainly not an incredible story. It's certainly one that's being treated seriously. I don't think you can just pretend that Hale is not credible. Look, what he's saying is that Clinton twisted his arm to setting up this bogus Small Business Administration loan to Whitewater. It was a $300,000 loan. I mean, if that charge is true, it's very serious. Hillary's tax return. She filed false tax returns. That's a violation of federal law. Look, Hillary claims that she kept confusing principal and interest on her losses on Whitewater.
This doesn't seem likely, does it?
It doesn't seem terribly likely. I mean, millions of Americans get their statements every year, and they don't seem to make these sorts of mistakes. And given that Hillary was a corporate lawyer advising banks, it's very bizarre to me that she got mixed up about this. So you've got false tax returns. And, you know, it's not just false tax returns. I mean, there was a reason for that, okay? They refused to release their tax returns for those years during the presidential campaign. This came out later. Well, it would have been very damaging to their campaign. So it's false tax returns and it's cover-up.
I wonder why there isn't more emphasis in any press, left, right, or center, on the fact that Whitewater is at bottom, as far as I'm concerned, largely a campaign finance scandal. And then a lot of the reason that the money had to be pushed around, moved around, and influenced around the way it was is because Bill Clinton was not an independent, wealthy person. He was not Steve Forbes, and he was running for office constantly and running for higher office eventually.
He was not a wealthy person. That's exactly right. And if these deals would have gone well, he would be a very wealthy person. That's the point. It's not just campaign finance. It's personal enrichment on the part of the Clintons, both of them. Hillary made a lot of money on the futures markets. If interest rates hadn't gone up, if the real estate market hadn't gone sour, they could have made a lot of money on Whitewater. And as it turns out, they didn't lose nearly as much as they should have because they received favors from powerful private interests.
And Larry, President Clinton stands in the way of campaign finance reform to continue.
He's one of the many people who stands in the way of it. Bob Dole is right up there in the way, along with Newt Gingrich, too.
Whitewater, your next story, Ken Silverstein?
The next story in the newsletter? I don't know yet. We'll still be following Whitewater. It's something that, of course, we're going to return to.
Do you think yesterday's 3.5 hours of testimony is going to show up in the media? Are we going to see the videotape? Are we going to hear the audio tape? Does it matter?
Yeah, it matters. I mean, look, I do think that that's going to be exploited, sure. I mean, I suspect there'll be some sort of leak. There'll be some tape. Something is going to show up, and it's going to be very embarrassing to the Clintons. So it matters to Bill Clinton. I mean, the fact that he had to testify, though, is his responsibility. It's because of actions he's involved in.
Ken Silverstein, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Counterpunch is his newsletter. The phone number people can call if they want to subscribe or get a copy of it.
202-986-3665.
That's 202-986-3665. Thanks, Ken. And thank you very much, Larry. Joining us from California, Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. Tune in tomorrow for a debate on abortion between Naomi Wolf, author of The Beauty Myth, and Katha Pollitt of The Nation magazine. It promises to be hot. If you'd like to get a copy of this show, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now!